Coming up on Golf Today, former world number one Dustin Johnson meets the media in London ahead of this week's first LIV Golf event. Why did he resign from the PGA Tour, and will he be allowed to compete in majors going forward? And the winner of the Memorial Tournament, Billy Horschel, stops by to talk about his big win at Jack's Place. What was their conversation like on 18? And just how many milkshakes did the Horschel kids consume? Plus, we react to the masterpiece spun by Min Ji Lee at the U.S. Women's Open at Pine Needles. Beth Ann Nichols joins as we put a bow on a magical week in Southern Pines. It's all ahead on Golf Today.
Golf Today, brought to you by PointsBet.
Golf Today on a Tuesday, Damon Hack alongside the great Jaime Diaz. And, buddy, I can't recall a time in this game that's been as busy as it is right now. That includes this from Tiger Woods, just released to social media. I previously informed the USGA I will not be competing in the U.S. Open as my body needs more time to get stronger for major championship golf. I do hope and plan to be ready to play in Ireland and at the Open next month. I'm excited to get back out there soon. So there you have the three-time U.S. Open champ, the 15-time major champ, Tiger Woods, not able to compete at Brookline next month. Your reaction next week, I should say.
This is good. This is good.
This is good.
I thought it was a struggle at Southern Hills. And he was an overreach. He was testing it. He was stress testing it. Found out a lot about himself. Probably needs more time. A lot of rough at the U.S. Open is not a great prescription for healing either, or for having, you know, peak performance at St. Andrews. I think, you know, even more than just focusing on majors, it's particular majors. And St. Andrews is the perfect major for Tiger Woods. So go in there optimized. Go in there with your best shot, because it's probably the last time he's going to play St. Andrews in an Open Championship. Perhaps he will, but, you know, it could be the last time. It's probably his favorite course.
Yeah.
Let's just have peak Tiger Woods, whatever that happens to be now, and this gives him the best chance to do that.
He calls it his favorite golf course on the planet. He's won two majors there by combined 13 shots, by 8 shots back in 2000, by 5 shots in 2005. How much is that the crux of this story, saying, well, I'm not going to do anything that could possibly jeopardize me having a chance to play his favorite golf course in the world?
I'm with you, Dame. I mean, he was really proud of the way he played at St. Andrews, especially in 2000. That was, it, for him, better than Pebble Beach.
Yeah.
He didn't win by as many, but he hit it better. And he just loves the history of it, the settings. I know he posed on a couple of three woods that are some of his favorite shots of all time. So he's got great vibes, great memories there. And, you know, Rory McIlroy, unfortunately, in 2015, hurt himself before St. Andrews.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's never been able to really feel without regret about that. And obviously totally different circumstances, but let's make sure Tiger, or he makes sure that he's not, you know, in any way compromised when he goes to St. Andrews. And it may be, you know, that could open up a chance for absolutely his greatest moment, but give himself a chance.
No doubt. So no Tiger Woods next week at the Country Club. But U.S. Open week is just around the corner. The National Championship returning to the Country Club in Brookline, Massachusetts next week. But before we go full throttle on the men's third major of the year, as of this morning, we were still waiting for the field to finalize. So a quick refresher. Yesterday, as you know, golf's longest day. Final qualifying for the U.S. Open. There were 9 final qualifying sites across the United States and Canada, with 49 total spots in the U.S. Open up for grabs. More than 650 players vying for those precious spots, north, south, east, and west, braving the elements and darkness, not to mention the nerves of trying to make it into a national championship. And by the end of the day, 7 of the sites had finished play, with these names punching their ticket to Brookline. You see big time Bo Hostler, the UT alum. How about Brian Stewart? He's made 7 U.S. Opens through the Springfield site, Jaime.
The Springfield rifle.
Absolutely. These are stories, I mean, you can't get enough. 57-year-old Fran Quinn in for his 5th U.S. Open. A couple of decorated youngsters, Michael Thorbjornsson and the Haskins Award winner Chris Goddard, ready to bring their precocious games to Brookline next week's golf's longest day, like Fiddler on the Roof. Sunrise, sunset, sunrise, sunset. 106 players for 13 spots. There's Lonto Griffin, the 2019 Houston Open champ, and Chan Kim, who shot 62. They're co-medalists and through to the U.S. Open. You got PGA Tour winner Joel Damon as well. Gotta love seeing that U.S. Open trophy by your name. That means Brookline is in your future. Danny Lee, U.S. amateur champ, is through as well. How about Wyndham Clark to make it through? Andrew Putnam from the Pacific Northwest. And there he is, Hayden Buckley, surviving that 5-for-1 playoff to get to Brookline. Meanwhile, down in Jupiter, Florida, they call it the hashtag Jupe Life.
Yes, the center of the PGA Tour.
Yes, it is. Admirals Cove was the site. There were two players who potentially could force a playoff, Spencer Mellon and Christopher Crawford, but neither of those two men were able to make a move this morning. So there it is, the final leaderboard at Jupiter for final qualifying. Ricky Fowler got the first alternate spot. That's very important for the 2015 Players' Champ. A good chance, Jaime, for him to get in.
Yeah, Ricky could use, you know, and he, who knows? You know, you find something he's inspired at the U.S. Open, could be something special.
Yeah, congrats to all those players.
Happy for Sean Jacklin, Tony's son.
Yeah, how about that?
Yeah, he hasn't had a lot of chances to play at the big time, and this is going to be great.
Tony Jacklin, 1970
yes.
U.S. Open champion, a member of the World Golf Hall of Fame. Neat to see these players make it in to the national championship. And new this morning, we turn our attention overseas. We're in London. Dustin Johnson, who was revealed to be playing in the first LIV Golf event, met with the media. And this is what some of what DJ had to say. For right now, I've resigned my membership on the tour, and I'm going to play LIV for now. That's the plan. What the consequences are going to be, I can't comment on how the tour is going to handle it. I can't answer for the majors, but hopefully they're going to allow us to play. Obviously, I'm exempt for the majors, so I plan on playing there unless I hear otherwise. Obviously, all things are subject to change. Hopefully, at some point, it will change and I'll be able to participate. If it doesn't, well, it was another thing I really had to think long and hard about. Ultimately, I decided to come to this and play out here. So the former world number one saying he too has resigned his PGA Tour membership and will play in this first event in London. Your reaction as this story continues to have legs, as we say in the business.
Well, in DJ's particular case, it seems like the majors really matter. And, you know, he's won two majors, obviously, and been close in several others. He's part of history. He's part of golf history. He's given that up to some extent by going to LIV. And I think he wants to retain as much as he can. For his own legacy, that still has a legacy. And he's won 24 times out on PGA Tour. He's getting the Hall of Fame. He's a legitimate star. He's third in being a number one behind Tiger and Greg Norman in terms of longevity there or duration. And I just feel like he's not lobbying right now, but you can feel in his words that, you know, I really hope I can get to still play in these majors. Otherwise, I'm in a world that, you know, is not going to be relatable to a lot of American golf fans as far as importance.
PGA Tour is the best tour in the world, the most competitive tour in the world. The players there have dreamed about being there since they were little kids. What does this tell you about perhaps a changing dynamic at the highest reaches of the game? Because, I mean, Dustin Johnson is not going to be competing against the best players in the world anymore. To me, this is about cash. This is not about going out and seeking the best competition. This is about what he said, what is best for me and my family.
Yeah, and Dustin's stature in the game and his record and where he sits in terms of what his peers think of him as a great player is sort of the first domino to me in terms of a true, substantial, important player going to LIV. And, you know, it's a test because maybe others could follow. Before that, I thought that the PGA Tour was keeping it, you know, quelling, you know, sort of an exodus. Dustin leaving brings in a new variable, you know, a different caliber of player that might be interested in doing this. And so he's a test pattern. And right now it's individual decisions still, but everybody's looking for little trends. Everybody's looking for what's going to fit between the cracks here, because right now there's a lot of unknowns. And I think Dustin is just someone everyone's going to really watch carefully to see how it works out for him.
And there are decisions yet to come, governing bodies deciding on whether they'll allow players from LIV to compete on a major championship stage, whether it's going to be a U.S. Open or an Open Championship. Mm-hmm. We have seen the commissioners and the CEOs of these majors work together on diversity or distance reports. How much do you sense that they will pull together in unison on this very controversial topic?
I think at this moment it sort of transcends the independents, and you'll see kind of a unified front to some extent, more visibly than other issues, I think. And it's because there is a possible existential threat. I mean, if there's a moment where, you know, everybody who's leading the game has to kind of weigh in and hopefully have strength in numbers, this may be it.
You've covered this game for decades, Jaime. Are you surprised that we've arrived to this moment?
A little bit. I was in, you know, I was at the at Greg Norman's first foray into trying something differently in 94. And at that moment, you know, there was a lot of certainty that we're going to make some inroads here. And the players, in the end, all backed away from it. Now, Tim Finchem did a masterful job intervening, probably. But I still feel like the players were very ambivalent. I think some of that ambivalence has left at this moment. A lot of it's just straight money. But a lot of it, too, is, you know, you look at the world of athletics and you see athletes, you know, trying new ventures and new platforms and new ways to earn. And it seems like it's the Wild West in some ways. And this is part of the Wild West now. So, you know, I don't know how it's going to be in a year, but right now this to me feels like a leap into an unknown world that, you know, we don't quite know how it's going to end, but we know the consequences and the stakes are extremely high.
How much will this shadow this summer? You know, we call it the championship schedule, the championship season. How much will this continue to be a storyline?
I think it's, honestly, in many ways, at least underlying, it's the number one story in golf because it has the most chance to affect everything that we're used to and that we value in the game and the way it's structured.
The story will continue to follow, and the schedule will continue to expand as we look ahead. Thursday, June 9th, RBC Canadian Open and the LIV Golf Invitational. You know, this is unprecedented. Saturday, June 11th, the LIV Golf Invitational concludes. Then you have Sunday, the final round of the RBC Canadian Open concludes. And then, of course, the U.S. Open takes place next week, Brookline, Massachusetts, at the Country Club. Notable dates upcoming in the game of golf. Well, Golf Today comes back. How about big-time Billy Ho, seven-time winner now on the PGA Tour. Going to join us after that fantastic weekend in Dublin, Ohio. That's next.
Golf Today, brought to you by PointsBet. This season, don't just bet, live your bet life. And WinGrips, the best grips in golf. And Bushnell Golf and the Pro XE, experience the best. And by introducing the Cobra King Forge Tech Irons, a better player's iron.
Back on Golf Today, Billy Horschel. This was the moment when he put the hammer down, I mean, basically said, game over. I love this par 5, 15.
Tiger-like on this one. Beautiful.
And look at that reaction, too. Like, you know, he's come a long way from, you know, the Zurich Classic celebration and when he's going. Now this is like, yeah, I expect to win.
Yeah, exactly.
This is what I do.
Act like I've been there before.
And he has been there before seven times now on the PGA Tour. A nice, tidy four-shot victory over Aaron Wise. Stunning 65 on Saturday and able to celebrate with his family. And as the players get older, they want to have these moments and kind of freeze frame them. You got the wife, you got the kids. Apparently the kids were like drinking up all the milkshakes from Dak's place. There you see that final round, 72. Sometimes it's just about being efficient, finding the way to get the victory in the house. That's what he did, and Billy Horschel joins us on this Tuesday. Great to see you now. You're a seven-time winner. Congratulations. I know winning is special on the PGA Tour, but then there's the time Jack Nicklaus is walking down the hill to congratulate you and tell you how clutch you are on the greens. What was that moment like?
Yeah, it's pretty special. You know, I play golf for a living, but I'm a massive golf fan. I watch a ton of golf. I love golf, and I've watched the event for so many years. I've played that event for almost a decade now, and I've always wanted to have that moment to have Jack congratulate me and talk about how well I played. And honestly, I try to play around the golf like Jack and Tiger would. You know, when they were leading golf tournaments, you know, they were just methodical and they plotted their way around the golf course. They didn't do anything special. And they made the other guys have to beat them. And that's what I did. I played really well. I was happy how I played and for Jack to congratulate me on that. And it's something that I will always remember.
Billy, you've had one multiple win season. You got a chance, obviously, this year for another one. What is the factor that causes that to happen? Is it more mental or physical? And do you feel like that's the next level for you, is to win more than once in a year?
Yeah, I've won twice. I won twice last year. I won on the WC Match Play, and I won the DP World Tour. Yeah. On the DP World Tour, the BMW PGA Championship, and then I won back to back in 14. But obviously, I want to win multiple times. That's the goal every year of mine. Not just win one year, once a year, but multiple times. I think that's shows how great of a player you are. You know, there's legacy when you do that. And for me, I think it's more or less it's more a mental thing. It's not physical. It's sort of not pushing too much harder. It's understanding that everything I do is how hard I work and everything I do on the golf course. I don't need to do anything more. I don't need to do anything special. I just need to believe in the process and sometimes, you know, just give myself a little bit of a break once in a while.
Billy, you're a passionate player. You run hot from time to time. You're not afraid to speak your mind. But I also sense this ease with you in your mid-30s. How are you different at 35 than you were at 25?
That's, you know, there is. I've had that sense of ease now for a few years. I think having kids is a massive help. Puts things into perspective. You know, you're trying to teach them how to become great people, how to treat people, how to do things correctly in the world. And I just think in the sense of golf, you learn and you mature. And, you know, you don't need to get upset after you make a couple bogeys in a row to, you know, kick yourself in the butt. You know, you can just sort of stay patient and understand where you are and the way you feel about your game. You don't always have to, you know, redline it right away. I can sort of, you know, still, you know, ease into it, and then if I have to redline it to kick myself in the butt a little bit, I do.
How about having the family there? Brittany, the kids, I mean, they got the milk mustaches going, having Jack's milkshakes. I mean, you just describe that scene. They're running out to give you a hug. I mean, they actually know what Daddy does for a living now.
Yeah, they do. It was the first time they've ever been at a victory of mine, my wife or my kids, so it's something that I've been trying to accomplish the last couple of years, and my wife doesn't like to fly in on a Saturday before or Sunday morning. She doesn't want to jinx the possibility of me winning. So we sort of wait until, you know, they just want to be there. And we had a chance to win this year at Bay Hill, and it just came up short to Scottie Scheffler. But, yeah, it was a special moment. And, yeah, they know what Daddy does. Their kids, their friends at school always talk about seeing me play on TV or something. So, yeah, they're understanding what I do for a living, and yeah, it's pretty exciting to see the emotion that they have.
Billy, really tumultuous time right now in professional golf. How do you see Phil Mickelson's decision to go to LIV Golf? Perhaps it's different, but how do you see DJ's decision? They're separate, but do you see a trend there? And as you watch this happen, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's tough. Like I said, I mean, I love the PGA Tour, and the PGA Tour has been so great to me, and it's been so great to so many other professional golfers over the years. And, you know, LIV is another opportunity for guys, whether it be a financial reason, whether it be the opportunity to play less events in a year. You know, everyone has their own reasons why they did something or why they're doing it. It's just sad that we may never see DJ play on the PGA Tour again, or Phil Mickelson, or maybe Kevin Na. You know, so, you know, it's tough. I try to understand every side of things and try to, you know, see it and play devil's advocate here and there. But like I said, I've always been happy with the PGA Tour. PGA Tour with Jay at the helm, he's trying to make it better. And some of the changes we are making are stuff that's been in the works for years, and some of it is due to LIV. But I believe we're going to have some exciting changes here in the next couple of years. And you know, I don't know if this is true or not, but I truly believe at some point in time down the road, the PGA Tour is going to be a global tour. We're going to play, you know, 10, 12 times outside the United States, and we're going to play 15, 18 times inside the United States. You're going to have a true global tour on the PGA Tour. And, you know, if that is the case that, you know, I believe may happen, I want to be, you know, at the forefront and help the PGA Tour lead, you know, their way into the future of that possible global tour.
You love the PGA Tour, Billy, now a seven-time winner. Can you imagine the act of resigning your PGA Tour membership, the golden ticket in this game?
Yeah, I don't understand why these guys have resigned their PGA Tour membership. Like I said, I love the PGA Tour, and I, I'm I'm all for the PGA Tour, but if they were so adamant about playing the LIV Tour, then why don't they just stay, you know, stand their ground and say, hey, you know, I want to play LIV and PGA Tour, and I'm going to stand my ground, and whatever comes of the PGA Tour and whatever, you know, hammer they throw down at us, you know, I'm going to either accept it or I'm going to, you know, fight it whichever way I can. But like I said, I don't understand their decision on that. I'm still trying to figure that one out, but you know, that's the decision they made, and the PGA Tour will continue to move on. We have so many great young players coming up on the PGA Tour. I think, you know, one guy that I played golf with earlier this year that I think is going to be a superstar here soon, people starting to understand who he is Cameron Young. Cameron Young is a hell of a player, and you got Will Zalatoris who's playing great golf, and it's just a matter of time before he gets a victory. So, you know, we've got so many great young studs on the PGA Tour coming up that's going to be the next torchbearers for the PGA Tour. You know, it's sad that these guys are going to leave, but the PGA Tour is going to back, you know, their product, and I'm going to be standing right next to them.
Billy, you played so well at Memorial, and you got Brookline coming up. You played great at the U.S. Open in 2013 at Marion, kind of an old-school golden age course. You're going to one that's even older. I just wonder how you feel about your game the way it is now, a more mature game going into a U.S. Open, especially coming off a win.
Yeah, I love the course that we're going to be playing next week. I haven't played it. My wife played it in a member guest last year, so she's got more experience than I do on it. But I was actually talking to my college coach, Buddy Alexander, yesterday, and we were just talking about the course and similarities between Marion, Brookline being a little bit longer, but obviously, the greens are going to be very small. I think the fairway is going to be pretty tight. You're going to have really good control of your golf ball. And I've learned a lot. You know, I wish the knowledge I have now I had back in 2013, because I truly believe it would have been a different outcome for me that week. But as I've grown over as a player in almost 10 years now, 13 years, I'm sure, but 10 years almost since then, I think if I can put myself back in that situation, I think I know how to handle a little bit better, and I think I know how to possibly close it out if I do end up in a situation where I have a chance to win the Open next week.
Billy, you're a ball-striking fool, and I say that with the highest compliment. Congratulations on your big win at Jack's Place, and good luck next week. Hope to speak to you soon.
Thanks, guys. Look forward to it.
Seven-time PGA Tour winner of the Memorial, Billy Horschel. All right, folks, time now. Let's take a look at the Comcast Business Tour Top 10. With his win, by the way, Billy Horschel shot up to 10th on this ranking. Scottie Scheffler still maintains a healthy lead with his four wins this season, followed by Sam Burns with 3 wins. And there's Cam Smith, the Players' Champ, couple wins, held off John Rahm in Hawaii.
How about Cameron Young, the way he endorsed him?
How about that?
Does he look great at the PGA? That, you know, people forgot he doubled that 16th.
That's
otherwise,
right.
He's right there.
Cam Young is coming, says Billy Horschel. Golf Today, back in just a little bit.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
News in the women's game to share with you. This morning, the Chevron Championship has officially found a new home after spending decades at Mission Hills Country Club in Rancho Mirage, California. The major championship will be moving to the Jack Nicklaus Signature Course at the club at Carlton Woods. Some notes, Woodlands, Texas, Jack Nicklaus Signature Course opened back in 2001, hosted the 2007 USGA Women's State Team Championship, hosted the 2014 U.S. Junior Amateur, will host the 2023 Chevron Championship. Fantastic news for the first major in the women's game. Meanwhile, last week, Minji Lee cruised to her second major championship victory, final round 71, birdie 1 and 2 on Sunday to say, this is going to be my day. Gold medal as well. Lowest 72-hole score in U.S. Women's Open history. See Annika, Julie Inkster, Inji Chun, 271. No one better. Let's hear from the champ.
Minji, just try to put this moment into words.
I mean, this is pretty special. This is the one that I've always wanted to win since I was a little kid. So it just feels pretty amazing to be able to get it done today, and I just can't believe it, pretty I just can't believe it.
Talk a little bit about the round today. It looked like you were in control for most of it, but how much were you paying attention? What were you feeling?
I was pretty nervous all day, to be fair. You know, I started good. I had two birdies off the bat, and it was nice just to have that little buffer. I made two bogeys on the front nine as well. And then I didn't hit it that well. I had really good saves, up and downs from a lot of the places. And then, you know, finishing, I had a couple birdies and a couple bogeys. So I think that was enough to, you know, get it done today.
Beth Ann?
Before I ask my first question, did you have any messages from Kari or your brother on that phone?
Oh, I mean, yeah, it's blowing up. I don't know. There's so many.
Well, was there one from Kari or no?
Oh, yeah. She texted me yesterday and the day before and probably today as well. Yeah.
Awesome. What were your emotions coming up 18? You know, not very many people get to enjoy that kind of walk with that kind of lead.
I just said to myself, this is pretty amazing. I mean, this is pretty cool. Just looking at the whole crowd and just everybody down the fairways, it was a pretty special moment for me.
Zephyr?
Minji, with the win, you join Kari Webb and Jan Stevenson as the only two Australian women to own more than one major championship. Have you reflected on your place in your country's golf history?
I mean, I haven't been able to even think properly at the moment, but you know, it's such a great honor just to be amongst those two names, so yeah, it's just really, really special.
Yeah. We're gonna hear it, Andrew.
Minji, you were quite poised out there until you were asked about what the prize money meant to you. What yes. do you think you might do with it, and tell us honestly, was it something you thought about at all this week?
To be honest, just maybe right at the beginning, because I like to, you know, keep on top of everything, you know, with what's happening with our tour and, you know, the ladies' golf. So, yeah, I did, but not when I was playing. I didn't even think about it at all.
And what might you do with it?
A lot of things. I'm not sure yet, but we'll see.
Jane?
Midge, you sat here last night and said that tomorrow I want to go make as many birdies as I can. That struck me as a really good, aggressive attitude to have as somebody with a big lead. Was that crucial for you?
You know, even with a 3-shot lead, I felt like I never felt comfortable today. You know, I felt like I still needed to play well. I still needed to hold my ground. So that's pretty much what I did. And to start aggressively, I think it was the right move. And then after that, I had quite a big shot lead. So I was able to just play my game just to finish.
Money's nice, but how about joining this list of U.S. Open champs at Pine Needles? Annika, Kari, who, tell you what, Minji went to the Kari Webb Scholarship. I mean, this is like some kismet, Jaime, some history. And Christy Kerr, I was there in 07 for the New York Times. She was in tears. She got that national championship. What a moment. These four players, a fantastic venue in Southern Pines, North Carolina. Our friend Beth Ann Nichols joins us now. You heard her voice in that winner's press conference. Beth Ann, first of all, great job. It was fun seeing you on the live from desk. Those glasses were fire, as my kids might say. But what was your big takeaway from Minji's record-setting win?
You know, I just couldn't help but think, how long will it be until she ascends to number one in the world? That I was thinking about that before she even teed off, because it seemed like, you know, it was obviously Minji's to win or lose. And the way the golf course was set up on Sunday was extremely difficult for anyone to make a huge run at her. So, you know, Minji was going to be the one to come back to the field. And you just look at her. She's so elegant. She looks so unflappable. Everything she tells you, she's not comfortable, but it looks so effortless out there. And now that she's a little bit longer off the tee than she has been and can be more aggressive when she wants to be, you know, you combine that with this incredible ball striking and this wonderful attitude and approach that she has, where she's so calm all the time. And you just start to think that, you know, are the floodgates going to open from here?
You know, Beth Ann, I thought the same thing, to be honest. I thought that this, she's on track to be the number one player in the world because she's made such great improvement. And I just wondered, you know, it reminded me of Annika when she got longer. Annika was great through the bag, very straight, no weaknesses, but she wasn't that long. When she got longer, it was an exponential jump. Do you see something similar in Minji because of that factor specifically?
You know, I definitely think so. You know, I mean, she says she's been working on this for a few years. And you can see her incrementally getting longer for the past few seasons. And she really goes hard at the gym. And she said everything's just falling into place right now where all that work is really coming together. So, you know, I like to look at, you know, Wikipedia actually is the best source for information on the rankings. And I like to go there to look to get some historical perspective because the rankings have only been around since 2006. So before Kari Webb would have been able to, or after, excuse me, Kari Webb would have been able to really ascend to number one and be in her prime. So an Australian has never been number one in the world. But Koreans have been number one for 295 weeks. Five different Koreans have totaled for almost 300 weeks. Three different Americans have a total of 59 weeks at number one in the world. And those are the only countries with multiple players that have been number one in the world since the Rolex rankings debuted. So I think it would be a massive thing for golf in Australia for Minji to become the first to ascend to the top.
Bethann, how about Ingrid Lindblad, who stole the hearts of fans last week? She also hung around at the live from desk wanting to see what Cara and Brandel and you and Paige were up to from a TV standpoint. What does her future look like?
You know, she says she's going back to college, and I commend her for that because I, you know, after this week, you know, it wouldn't be surprising if she thought twice about that. But I think she's a lot of fun. And with the power that she has, the putting display that she put on through the first three rounds, she didn't miss a putt from inside 10 feet. It was 49 for 49. It was mind-blowing. And she's teeing it up again this week, actually, in Sweden in the Scandinavia mix that's hosted by Annika Sorenstam, who she played alongside in the first two rounds. Annika will be playing again this week, as will Henrik Stenson, their co-host. And so it's going to be really fun because this is an event where men and women play for the same purse, $2 million purse, from different sets of tees. And, of course, Ingrid's still an amateur, so she can't collect any money, but I mean, as long as she is and the momentum and the high that she's riding, I'm excited to see what she does in Sweden, literally, you know, in her backyard at Halmstad.
Yeah, she's kind of a blend of Laura Davies and Caroline Hedvall, in my opinion. You may recall her from the European Solheim Cup team. You know, we previously mentioned the club at Carlton Woods has been announced as the course for the Chevron Championship. Your overall impressions, especially getting a new April date outside of the shadow a bit of the Masters tournament, for example.
Right. Well, I think that the date is the most important thing, as you say, moving away from the Augusta National Women's Amateur, which, of course, they overlapped for a few years now. And there's going to be a week in between the Masters and the Chevron, which I think will be fantastic. Interestingly, there's actually a Champions event that's going to be the week after the Chevron at the Woodlands. So there'll be back-to-back at the Woodlands, but the women are going first. You know, I called Stacey Lewis because as a player who grew up in the Woodlands, she's the first one I thought of to get some perspective as a past champion of this event. And she said this course, while she hasn't played it a lot because it was a private course and not one that was part of her membership at the Woodlands, she said that she felt that it could be set up for a major championship test with the runoffs. The greens can become firm and fast, grow the rough up. But really the thing she was most excited about was the number of juniors that are in the area. Stacey said that 20 years ago, almost, when she was in high school, there were 30 girls on her high school team, which is just mind-blowing to me. She said there are so many juniors, and when she thinks back to what that would have meant to her to have a major championship in that area, you know, I mean, she already rose to number one in the world, but how many kids will have that dream after seeing a major championship up close and personal. So I'm excited about that, and I'll be interested to see it. I've never been to that course, so it should be fun.
I haven't been there either. Looking forward to it. There's a big event, it seems like, every week on the golf schedule. Marion plays host to the Curtis Cup this week, biennial competition between the U.S. and Great Britain and Ireland. Who are some of the young players, amateurs, you'll be watching for?
Well, I mean, of course, we can't get enough of Rose Zhang, can we? So she'll be back, world number one, along with Rachel Heck, who wasn't at the U.S. Women's Open this year. Unfortunately, she had to pull out of her qualifier because she was sick. But excited to see her. You know, it's Amari Avery will be playing in her first Curtis Cup. Rachel Keene. There's five players who are returning from last year's roster because it's just back to back. So we haven't had as many players turn pro as you normally would. But you know, I think at Marion, it's the first time the Curtis Cup will be held at Marion. Of course, it will be a future U.S. Women's Open venue. So I think this will be kind of a preview, even though it's match play, and into maybe how that course might be set up and how it might play for a U.S. Women's Open. So that's something to keep an eye out for. But, you know, when I look at this team, it's really exciting. I kind of compare it a little bit to 2004, which was my very first Curtis Cup that I went to. And little did we know that three major champions would be on that team. And Michelle Wee West, Brittany Lang, and Paula Creamer, who all went on to win the U.S. Women's Open. And I think there's a lot of firepower on this team and a lot of players that could have long careers on the LPGA.
I can't wait to see how it all shakes out. Beth Ann, great job last week. Thanks for your contributions to Live From and to Golf Today. Today, we'll speak to you soon.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Coming up on Golf Today, three-time U.S. Open champ, 15-time major champ, Tiger Woods informs the USGA he will not be competing in the national championship next week at the Country Club. And more news from the USGA as the field is getting set for that national championship. Who is in and who is out? Breaking news coming up on Golf Today.
Golf Today, brought to you by PointsBet.
Golf Today on a Tuesday, another hour. Damon Hack alongside Jaime Diaz, one of the great writers in our game. We have breaking news on this Tuesday. A lot going on. This released moments ago from the United States Golf Association. We pride ourselves on being the most open championship in the world, and the players who have earned the right to compete in this year's championship, both via exemption and qualifying, will have the opportunity to do so. Our field criteria were set prior to entries opening earlier this year, and it's not appropriate nor fair to competitors to change criteria once established. Regarding players who may choose to play in London this week, we simply asked ourselves this question. Should a player who had earned his way into the 2022 U.S. Open via our published field criteria be pulled out of the field as a result of his decision to play in another event? And we ultimately decided that they should not. Our decision regarding our field for the U.S. Open in 2022 should not be construed as the USGA supporting an alternative organization, nor supportive of any individual player actions or comments. Rather, it is simply a response to whether or not the USGA views playing in an alternative event without the consent of their home tour an offense that should disqualify them for the U.S. Open. And with that, we welcome in the CEO of the USGA, Mike Wan. Mike, we appreciate your time. We spoke yesterday. You said you wanted final qualifying to play out. What was the process of coming to this decision today?
Yeah, hi, Damon. Hi, Jaime. Two things. I mean, I said to my team, we will not gather to make this decision until Monday night. There was two things I was trying to avoid. I didn't want Mike Wan or the USGA to divert the media attention in the middle of the women's greatest championship for them, nor did I want to interrupt the longest day and the grind that it takes to get into the U.S. Open. I know we're all seemingly never satisfied with the amount of live discussion we seem to be able to have today, and that's fine. It's not my job to decide what we do or don't talk about. I just didn't want to make sure that I added to the diversion, if you will. And so wanted to make sure we finished the U.S. Women's Open, wanted to make sure we got through, for the most part, the longest day so that we could get together and sort of officially notify you of where we stand. And I get it. There's going to be emotional reactions on both sides of this, but we believe that we published this field criteria. We created it, a year ago, published it, I think, early February. And I think making changes to that the week before because of where somebody chose to play this weekend was neither fair to the competition or to the competitors. And we're a group that believes a little bit in rules and regulations, and we posted these for quite a while.
Mike, you know Jay Monahan is going to discipline these players eventually, perhaps soon. You've been a commissioner of a tour. Do you feel like your decision in any way undermined the authority of the PGA Tour?
I hope not, Jaime. I mean, I don't think anybody, I don't think we have to defend our support of the PGA Tour. We have a longstanding relationship with them. We proudly recognize them as the strongest, most influential tour in the world, a position they've certainly earned. You know, if you look at who gets into the USGA, we have most years, maybe as many as 10 different tours represented in a U.S. Open. But the PGA Tour is always, you know, the biggest representation. I mean, we take their players who finish in their tour championship. They all get in this year. Multiple winners get in on the PGA Tour, which doesn't happen on other tours. And certainly when we take the players from the best in the world rankings, they tend to come from the PGA Tour as well. You know, it's not easy, but, you know, if you go back to February of this year, I don't know, close to 30 players actually had releases from the PGA Tour to go play in the same country for the same organizer. The DP World Tour had a sanctioned event in this country with this organizer for many years. So I think the only difference is this is the week before the U.S. Open, and maybe in this case they don't have that approval, which I understand that. And as a former commissioner, I'm not sure I would do anything different. But as it relates to the U.S. Open, didn't feel right for us to say in the dispute of where a player played, which is between their home tour and them, not sure that for us qualified removing somebody who had otherwise qualified with their play.
Mike, the statement's pretty explicit that this is the 2022 U.S. Open. Do you retain the right to have a different approach in 2023, for example?
Sure we do, Damon. I mean, it's a 127-year-old championship. Our field criteria is certainly not the same today as it was when we got started in 1895. I'm pretty sure it'll be modified as we go. We've, even before talking about this topic, obviously we've been looking at other qualifiers as it relates to amateurs and maybe some people off the FedEx Cup points. We've already been considering some changes for 23, and I think it's safe to say, Damon and Jaime, that what this thing, meaning LIV, is and will become will be different. We're talking about something different today than we were talking about 4 months ago or 14 months ago. Fairly certain we'll be talking about something different 12 months from now than what it is today. And what that is, we don't know. So we feel like this has been a moving target, and we want to see what that is. I've said many times, there's nothing easier than launching a new business. It's full of excitement. You can get wealthy people to back it. I've been a part of that for 12 years in terms of running a tour. I've had a lot of wealthy people launch championships. But the hard part is in a couple of years, you didn't become a wealthy person without requiring a rate of a return on your investment. And the hard part of this is still to come. Building title sponsors, TV deals, insurance, operations. It's not easy. And you guys know it because you cover it week in and week out. And so the real challenge, I've said to many people, I remember how exciting USFL was. And I remember how difficult it was to turn it into a going proposition. Don't know where this will play. But we're certainly not going to make decisions on 23, 24, 25 based on the excitement of a launch. We'll want to see what it becomes.
Mike, at this moment, how important is it for the leaders of the major organizations, the USGA, the RNA, Augusta National, the PGA of America, and the PGA Tour, to unify to protect the structure of professional golf?
I don't know that our unification on the structure of golf is the right position, Jaime. At the end of the day, we're very different than Augusta National in terms of how they build their field criteria. We're pretty different than the PGA of America. And even though you would consider both of us open, my field criteria and Martin's field criteria is different as well. We are awfully unified in a lot of things. You know, and I could list, you know, a long list starting from before COVID and only going into hyperdrive after COVID in terms of growing the game initiatives and what we invest in together and DEI programs. But as it relates to our actual championships and the field criteria, I can think of, I've been here 12 months, I've never had a conversation with another leader about my field criteria. And I can't really remember anybody from Augusta ever asking me about theirs, or same with Seth. So I think at the end of the day, you know, do we love this difference? You know, everybody probably has their own point of view on that. And, you know, personally, I have my own point of view as well. But it's what I had to decide yesterday was, does the establishment of this and people playing in this weekend affect their ability to play in an event that they've qualified for otherwise? And that decision wasn't as hard as you may think. Longer term, that may become different. But based on what's on the table today, it wasn't that difficult.
Mike, Phil Mickelson said he spoke with organizations that run the majors and that from those conversations, he got the impression he could play in the U.S. Open. And he's had a very rocky relationship with the USGA, admittedly, throughout the years. How would you characterize your conversations with Phil regarding next week?
Yeah, I think most of Phil's conversations, to be honest, have been with Jason, and that's good because Jason and I talk about every 7 minutes. Listen, Damon, we don't fill our field based on my personal feelings. We fill our field based on the criteria we establish and whether or not you've earned the right in. Phil earned the right in by winning the PGA Championship. He's got an exempt status on the U.S. Open as a result of that. On a personal basis, I'm struggling a little bit with whether or not it's disingenuous to call this all about the new exciting format for the fans. I've never been asked, what would you feel if you could only have to work, 10 times a year and get paid significantly more money than I'm being paid today? So I can't relate to what that feels like, but I understand that question is being asked and some are falling on both sides of the line and maybe this will turn into something very significant and maybe it won't. So I have to, and I think you guys can appreciate that. How I personally feel about any player, Phil or anybody else, shouldn't probably influence whether or not somebody has earned their right into the U.S. Open, and it didn't in this case. It's, I think fortunately for everybody, Mike Wan's personal opinion won't determine who plays in a USGA championship, whether it's the U.S. Open or any other championship.
Mike, you're a student in golf history. How would you characterize this moment in the context of the history of the professional game?
Undefined. I think we're all trying to define what this means for the future, and is it different, disruptive, confusing? Sure, all those things. But I think I mean it. When I sat on the Rolex World Rankings on the women's side, I saw a lot of PowerPoint presentations about a bunch of new tours that were going to be created, none of which are with us today. As a former commissioner, I have got a lot of very wealthy entities and individuals to invest in the game. And like I said, what I know about that process is that's the easy part. The press conference, the launch, the excitement of what can be. The hard part is pretty soon into that process, whoever you got to invest in that business is going to want to know whether or not this is a going business. Or every year you're going to come ask me for, another couple $100 million or more. And wealthy people didn't become wealthy by continuing to do that. So there's a lot of hard work to do for LIV to be with us years from now. I don't know. It won't be up to me whether it is or isn't a going viable position. But I feel like all of us, at least in what I read, are jumping to conclusions about the success of something. Launching a new business and your opening press conference is the easy part. Creating a business that pays for itself and returns investment back to the people that helped launch it is the tough part. And I'm not saying it's not achievable. I'm not saying it's not doable. On a personal level, if you ask me about the game of golf, I would say, all of us as fans, myself included, just want the greatest golfers in the world to come together and play against each other on a more frequent basis. This feels to me like maybe is even splintering that concept more. And it seems like, players won't come together and play that often. That's too bad as a fan, but not up to me in terms of how that plays out. So, personal feelings, different than my decision as it relates to whether or not somebody plays next Thursday at the Country Club.
Mike, just a quick follow-up. Based on the assumption that the Saudi investment fund has almost unlimited funds, does that make them an exception to the situation you're talking about in general?
No chance. Unlimited funds, you don't get to unlimited funds by being a bad business person. Unlimited funds gives you the freedom to invest in some really, exciting new things. And I'm sure they're doing this and they think this is one as well. But things don't stay exciting if you're wiring $500 million a year 5 years from now. So the reality of it is they got to turn it into a business, and I don't know what their time frame is to do that. But does this change those rules? Never seen anything change that business rule. Don't think this one is either. In their ability to launch something bigger than the average person could start, yes, that's definitely an exception to the rule in terms of size of the thing. But I think all of us are jumping to conclusions about what 2025 is going to look like, and I guess, it's funny to say because I always thought of myself as the young guy in the game and now I'm the old guy. But I think I've been around and seen enough. I've definitely seen enough exciting launches and PowerPoint presentations to sit back and say, let's see what this looks like in 2 years, because this year is the easy one. It's further down the road where it gets harder.
Well, a lot of people want to know, Mike, what next week is going to look like. So what concerns do you have that players coming from LIV might bring negative attention to the national championship?
Yeah, I mean, that's I don't know what the reaction will be there, Damon. And, unfortunately, I don't really feel like Mike Wan gets to sit in the seat to decide if you bring negative attention to our championship, even though you've earned your right. I'd have you sit out. At the end of the day, I mean, I don't love everybody who plays professional golf. And I promise you, everybody who plays professional golf does not love me. I mean, I've proven that in my time in the business. And that's okay. At the end of the day, we're pretty clear about how you have to get into a U.S. Open. And it's I've said many times, getting to the U.S. Open is making the cut. 9,300 people tried to get here. And, 156 are going to find their way standing there on a Thursday. So there's a reason why we pay even the people who missed the cut, because we think making the cut is making it to Thursday. I'm going to respect that. My personal opinions about what you did last week or yesterday, what you've said about us or other people, is not going to be part of next week's story, at least as it relates to me. I'm going to respect the fact that the best in the world earned their way into this championship. And if you're going to win at the country club, I promise you, you're going to have played the best golf of your life, because every club in your bag is going to be dirty, including the one between your ears. I mean, this is a course that's going to make you think, it's going to make you frown, and it's going to make you work. But I think if you're standing at the end, you won't have to have anybody tell you that you're the best in the world. You'll know it because of what you'll have achieved at the country club. No matter what goes on around the world or how you got here, that's not going to change when it comes to being the one who holds the trophy on Sunday.
Mike, there are business decisions and then there are personal decisions, and you had to make a critically important business decision here. You have, but do you have thoughts personally as it relates to LIV and the players leaving to join that organization?
Yeah, like I said, I mean, I feel it's maybe a little disingenuous, to hear people talking about how this is all about exciting new formats and fan changes. I mean, there's nothing about what's happening in professional golf right now that seems to question viewership interest, fan interest, engagement, on-site. Everything is up and through the roofs. And quite frankly, in 22, better than we've almost ever seen, including what it's meant to growing the rest of the game. So I get it. I mean, it's another lifestyle and maybe another income style. And if that's right for you, then it's not for me to pass judgment. Like I said, I've not been faced with that decision, so I can't critique somebody else's ability to make that. But that's that is what it is, and won't get in the way of USGA championships. I would say, Damon, if you give me a second, I'd like to say something I probably should have said 2 years ago, and I really feel like the golf world needs to hear this, and that is a, I don't know if this is the right phrase, but I guess it saddens me a little to hear anybody critique or unfairly criticize Jay Monahan and the PGA Tour's leadership as it relates to creating opportunities and growing those opportunities for their players. And certainly it saddens me to hear a player that actually benefited from his leadership critique that if somebody wants to play somewhere else, then they go someplace somewhere else. But listen, I had a front row seat when this thing called COVID hit us in 2020. And I was the first to back out because I wasn't sure of the answers. And I probably would have sat down the entire season of 2020 had it not been for Jay Monahan, who got on the phone with me and said, Mike, we're not going to steer into fear. We're going to steer into success. Follow us. And he actually invited our team up to learn how they were going to work through COVID. I probably got back on the golf course at the LPGA as the LPGA commissioner at least 4 months earlier than I would have if it wasn't for Jay's leadership and his collaboration with the rest of the world. And I've said this many times, but maybe not this publicly. All of us in the industry have a debt of gratitude to that guy, because he not only got professional golf going again, which led to college golf and everything else going again, but he got the golf industry going again. And through him and Seth and a few others that all of us came together, the way we petitioned the government, we got golf courses open again. And as a result, this sport is in a place it's never been before. So all of this aside, I would just say that there is no bigger fan of Jay Monahan, not because of LIV or anything else. It's just because I've watched the guy, quite frankly, help save my tour at the LPGA and my players' opportunities and his tour and his players' opportunities. And if any player, sponsor, fan has already forgotten that, shame on us, because this game would look and feel a lot different in 2021 and 2022 had he not been in the position he was in 2020. And I want him to know, his tour to know, and my tour back at the LPGA to know that we're appreciative of that guidance and that leadership.
Mike, based on your knowledge of the LPGA players, how do you think they would react to a rival league like LIV coming and offering them the kind of offers or using the same model that they're using on the men's tour right now?
Probably similar, Jaime, to what's happening on the men's tour, meaning it's not for everybody. I'm sure some people would reject it out of hand. Some people would probably grind out over it for a year, and some people would be quick to jump on board. I mean, it's as you know, Jaime, it would be a lot easier to get an LPGA or LET player intrigued by guaranteed money over the next few years that it could be life-changing. I mean, there's not many players on the LPGA privately flying to their events and bringing their cook and masseuse. It's just not that lifestyle. And I say that as a critique to me. It's what I was trying to create for them. I know we've raised things a lot in my 12 years there, but I didn't leave feeling like it was anywhere near finished. So, yeah, as I've said, I mean, I believe it. I don't know what would happen if somebody said to me, Mike, how would you like to work for 10 weeks and make significantly more money over the next couple of years? I get it. I mean, I get the fact that will get people to scratch their head and think differently. I don't know if that makes it more interesting, watchable, and enjoyable for the fans and makes the sport better. But I understand the individual dialogue that probably has happened on some kitchen tables. And I'm sure those dialogues would happen on LPGA tables as well. I'm not sure at the end of the day those players would honestly stand up and say this is all for the betterment of the game. But I don't know. I don't know what they would or wouldn't say. So, yeah, I mean, it's none of us can honestly say what would happen in our life if somebody made the same offered us. But I don't think people are running to a much better mousetrap. I don't think people are thinking all the things that are wrong with current professional golf. I don't think anybody can say that with a straight face, but I also understand somebody offering you a life-changing, maybe family-changing opportunity, and let's just call that what it is.
Mike, you've been in the business world. You were the LPGA commissioner when it was bereft of sponsorships and having infighting in the back rooms. You've guided an LPGA through the COVID-19 pandemic. Where does this live entity sit in terms of being a distraction beyond the day-to-day work of setting up championships and being an arbiter of this great game?
The biggest distraction is this, Damon, right? I mean, I'm a week away from our national championship. And the fact that we just had, qualifiers in 44 states, we had players from 50 different states and 80 different countries try to get there. Any other year, we would be talking about that, and we're talking about this. So, you know, to me, what this means to the game long term is really, you got to focus on the last part of that answer, long term. I mean, like I said, I've seen my share of launches, and I get it. This is loud and expensive and glitzy. I don't know what this will mean long term. What it means in the short term is an awful lot of people talking about an awful lot of things that are different than what we probably should be talking about, which is the fact that Minjee Lee just had a record-setting performance last week. Billy Horschel just, you know, had an incredible win at Jack's Place, and a couple of days later, we're talking about something going on in London for 3 days and a shotgun start, and that's the disappointing part of it. Where did it mean to the game long term? I don't know. I'm not smart enough to forecast. I've been right sometimes and wrong sometimes on the long-term plan. In the short term, I hope at least next week, and I'll probably be wrong, we can talk about the greatness that'll happen between hole number one and 18 green. But my guess is we'll divert a lot of that attention to this, and that's the only thing that's really unfortunate for me, and I think for a lot of fans who love the game.
Mike, any final comments or thoughts before we let you go?
No, I appreciate you guys taking the time, and I appreciate the fact that there's going to be strong points of view on both sides of this. I'm not here to say I'm right or to talk you into our position or some other position, but we felt because we had competitors calling us and asking us the situation, and because, you know, we all deserve to know kind of what the field is or isn't as it relates to these people that just went through the longest day in golf, we wanted to make sure it was clear what our field at least would be in the 2022 U.S. Open.
Mike, we appreciate you being so generous with your time, and we'll see you next week at the Country Club.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Mike.
Mike Wann, CEO of the USGA. Your thoughts on that conversation?
Well, it was, you know, the guy is amazing in terms of just a torrent of cogent thoughts, one after another. I think he did rely on a model that was sort of antiseptic and saying, look, you know, we don't interfere in other players, in other organizations and criteria on their field, and nobody interferes in ours. Mm. And as a result, you know, yeah, they didn't get a release from the PGA Tour. Is that enough for me to say you should not be able to play in the U.S. Open? He didn't think it reached that threshold. I think personally, and I think he addressed it too, this is a slightly elevated situation. It's not in that clean vacuum that he presented, but I understand the principle, and I think probably in terms of liabilities and all kinds of complications that would occur if they acted otherwise, this was probably the wisest course.
Hard for an open championship to remove players who are already exempt. How much is that the crux of this story?
Yeah, I think that is the crux, and he did boil it down to that. You know, I know he understands Jay Monahan's position. He gave us a long,
glowing,
and I'm sure he empathizes. But in his role right now, representing his championship, I think he thought long and hard and thought that was the crux, that was the essence. Let's stay with the essence and not let too much noise interfere with our decision here.
I also heard a man who seemed to want to kind of separate what his personal feelings might be about Liv from running this championship and what this championship has always been, which is open, which is about the players who find a way through official World Golf ranking or through golf's longest day, final qualifying, or through their performance in major championships to be in there. So while he, I thought, made it pretty clear that he may not love the focus being on money and not being on competition, but he was not willing to sacrifice what the kind of the DNA of the U.S. Open has been.
And that's leadership. I mean, that's what people in big positions constantly have to do is take emotion out of it, take personal feelings out of it, think of the greater good, think of the founding principles, and I think he did that. You know, he also talked about Liv as a business entity more than I've heard mostly. I think we've all given them sort of this special power of never running out of money, and
great
he said
point.
That is not the issue. He goes, he knows a lot of rich guys because, you know, he deals with a lot of sponsors, and there's always a limit. And he said the Saudis also have a limit, and let's see what that means in 2 years, which I think takes away a little of the urgency of the emergency that we're feeling right now. You know, maybe it's let's take a little bit of a more temperate view about what's actually possible by Liv. You know, it seems like right now they look like they could just buy golf. But that's not the case, and at least from his perspective, I think he's got some experience to say that. It's probably a good thing to know that there's people who actually have seen, you know, incredibly wealthy people finally say, you know, it's not worth it anymore.
Quickly, do you expect that the focus will be on the championship next week or in this era of Twitter and Instagram, that there will be issues outside the ropes as well?
There have been distractions before. I think in the end, great golf, especially on a major championship site, with so much history at stake, which speaks well for golf, really drowns out everything else, and it becomes the focus. Now, if some player during the week chooses to say, you know, I'm going to Le Golf or something like that, of course, that will become a news item. But as long as everything is about playing that week by the players, I think it'll be what our attention is on.
A fascinating time in our game. The schedule for the next couple of weeks on the golf calendar, Thursday, June 9th, the RBC Canadian Open and Liv Golf Invitational. They tee off. That's Thursday, June 9th. Saturday, June 11th, the final round of the Liv Golf Invitational. Sunday, June 12th, final round of the RBC Canadian Open. And then, yes, next week, Thursday through Sunday, the U.S. Open at the Country Club takes place. Golf Today, back in a minute. Back on Golf Today, Minji Lee is now a two-time major champ after cruising to victory at the U.S. Women's Open last week. Entered that final round with a three-shot lead, birdied one and two, and said good night. Final round 71 to win by four shots. How about U.S. Women's Open champs representing Australia, Jan Stevenson, Kari Webb a couple of times, back-to-back, 2000-2001, then Minji Lee getting it done on Sunday in style. And yes, the richest purse in women's golf, $1.8 million for Minji Lee. How about $1.08 million for Mina Haraguy? Let's hear from Mina.
I think that was probably one of the top rounds where I was really nervous. But I think I handled it pretty well for the situation, so I'm proud of myself.
Yeah, obviously you came up just a little bit short of that top goal, but what are some of your main takeaways from this week?
The main takeaways are I really am able to handle myself out there, and, you know, I belong up there.
Yeah, Beth Ann?
You know, what was going through your mind at the finish when you realized that you just won $1 million?
I'm not going to lie, my stomach hurt the last couple holes coming down. I was really stressed out, but I was really just focusing one shot at a time, making solid contact and just hitting good putts.
Had you looked at the leaderboard to realize how kind of stacked it was there in second?
I did. I looked at it on 14, 15, and then my birdie obviously helped on 16, so that's when I saw that I had a two-shot lead in front of third.
Shane?
On the topic of the money, I think this is right, that you're the first woman ever to win $1 million at a tournament by finishing second place. I mean, that's pretty cool, right?
Yeah,
not just for
really
you,
cool.
But for the women's game and what it says about everything.
Yeah, that is really cool. I didn't really think about that. So yeah. If this is the trend where women's golf is going, I think it's great.
Great trend indeed. Big week for Mina and for Minji. Jane Crafter, by the way, told me in 2015 that Minji Lee had talent equal to Lydia Ko. And I think we're starting to see that now. Best storyline maybe outside of Minji, though, this past week?
Well, it's a little bit personal because I get to play the golf course a lot, and it's just wonderful to see Pine Needles look so good and play so well and test the best players so much. It's such a soulful place, such a great golf place. Mm. And Kyle Franz's restoration enhanced that. It played and looked like an old golf course, but it had a lot of modern, obviously, adjustments to the way they play now. And you saw the front of the greens and the sides of the greens really shaped, you know, the kind of ball striking that it required. And even really great control players had a hard time, you know, if they missed a little bit. And so Minji's victory as a result, I think, was a validation of the golf course. And then just personally also, I don't get out enough to see the LPGA players like I used to. Yeah. And it was a great experience just sit on the range and watch the modern players today. And I just thought there was more speed, stronger physiques, better contact. Ball going a lot farther. Mm. Watched Annika, you know, and she's a wonderful throwback, but you see the young players now, and even the ones of not a great stature just have a lot more efficiency in their golf swings, and they hit the ball in places they didn't used to hit it.
Yeah.
And it's a higher quality of golf.
Minji Lee, 77th to 21st in driving distance in just a couple of years. For me, it's Mina Harik, guy. I mean, she was 0 for 26 in terms of top 10s in major championships. She picked the right time to get her first one at Pine Needles. That runner-up finish, that more than $1 million for second place, that's life-changing money for a player who admittedly was down to hundreds of dollars in her bank account trying to find a way to keep the dream alive. And for her to play with the pressure of trying to take home a big check, I mean, she didn't get the trophy, but she got some job security, some life security.
Well, she really hung tough to get that second place. So it was almost like a win in that sense, because it will make her life better and her career better.
Yeah. Did you see the drone footage also? There's some drones that were flying around. I mean, Pine Needles look, I'm sure it looked better in person.
No,
and I
the
was
drones
jealous,
are amazing.
But it looked good on TV also.
I don't think there's a better way to see a golf course than a drone.
Yeah.
As far as really seeing, you know, the whole scope of it, but also the detail. And I think it's helped golf architecture quite a bit.
You have a sense why it's Annika, Kari, Christy, and now Minji. I mean, the quality of champions at Pine Needles, I mean, it's a who's who.
Ball control, ball striking, the classic, you know, kind of measurements that determine whether somebody can really play when the targets are small. Now, it's a wide fairways, but that was what was interesting. You still had to be really on point when you came into the greens, and around the greens, you had to have great contact.
Yeah.
And so not everybody's a great chipper, but most of those players that have won are really good through the bag. And when it comes down to it, they know how to hit a golf shot solidly under pressure. And that's really what it tested.